If we could call the meeting of the Commerce Committee to order, if members could find their seats, members and guests. I don't think we have a quorum present yet, but we're close. So Representative Purcell, if you want to come down and tell us everything you want to have us hear about your bill, we probably are three or four people away from being able to officially vote on it. But if you want to go ahead and start telling us what you want us to hear, then we can act as soon as we have a quorum. And if you guys could identify, whoever is going to speak, if you could identify yourselves for the record, we would appreciate it. And we need to move the bill in front of us. I will go ahead and move House File 305, and it's properly before us. Representative Purcell, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regret that we don't get to spend more time together in committee anymore. We aren't on the same committee, so I miss those opportunities. Committee members, I bring before you today House File 305, and I have with me Mr. Bruce Mead, who is the primary subject matter of this bill, if you will. And what we're asking the committee to consider here is for approval of a detached banking facility. You have the bill in front of you, I believe, and where this would be for a location in a township, Northern Township. And as you all may be aware, we're working with some law. The current law is about 40 years old, and this requires banks that want to set up their business, requires them to gain Minnesota Department of Commerce approval to move into cities with 10,000 population or greater. And for cities less than 10,000 population, the new bank is required to gain approval from banks within the city and the Minnesota Department of Commerce. But there's no current law governing banks moving into townships. And so to accomplish this, there's two steps involved: to accomplish a new bank for a township and approval from the township, which we do have, and for a bill to be passed by the legislature and approved by the governor, signed by the governor. So that is, okay. We're at this first step here, Mr. Chair, and if Mr. Mead, do you have anything you want to add to what I've said?
Okay. If you have anything, if you'd like to go ahead and identify yourself for the record and anything you want us to know, feel free.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bruce Mead. I'm Senior Vice President of Altima Bank, Minnesota. We are an independently owned bank, community bank, located in Winger, Minnesota, with a branch in Fawston. And I currently operate a licensed or loan production office in the township of Northern, just outside of Bemidji. Actually, across the street is the city of Bemidji, and I am in Northern Township. We want to expand that office to be a full branch, to offer full banking services, and to do so, the first step is to gain legislative approval, and the next step then is to go to the Department of Commerce for the regular application.
That sounds good. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, when I was visiting with the folks from Bemidji yesterday, I visited Representative Purcell a little bit about my tremendous support of this bill and how important I thought it was, and how, since there was no opposition from other area banks and so forth, that I'd be fully supporting, in fact, probably getting on the bill as a co-author. Then come to find out that Mr. Mead shows up today in my office, and he is a distant relative through several marriages of, I think it goes back to Columbus or something, but it's way down there. So of course I talked to Mr. Mathewitz, and And, of course, there's actually no conflict of interest because it's far enough. I think it's like eighth cousin, twice removed or something. And so I'll be recusing myself from the vote, even though I don't have to, so I cannot express my tremendous support for this bill at this time.
Well, thank you, Representative Davids. And it actually is in our commerce rules that if you are an eighth cousin twice removed, that is right there the step that puts you far enough away to remove any doubt.
And, Mr. Chairman and members, I would not want to in any way, because there's some shirt tail relative way down the road, affect the outcome of the vote of this bill. But I can't tell you that I think everybody should vote for this because I'm recusing myself from the vote.
Representative Davids, in the future, would you please not beat around the bush and just let us know how you think we should vote on something?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions relative to, you said you're right across the street from Bemidji City?
Yes, sir.
Why was annexation into the city of Bemidji not an option to in having to incur the expense and time and energy of special legislation for this?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we are in an area that is in an annexation plan with Northern Township and the city of Bemidji. However, we're still 10 years out from our area being annexed. We are leaseholders where we are at, so we do not have the standing of a property owner to request annexation.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? I've got a question for the author. Representative Purcell, where do we want to send this if it passes this committee?
I would ask for your guidance on that, if we...
Dan says we should send it to government operations, and now that he said that, I remember that he did tell me that before. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill? I'm not aware of anybody, but we should ask. Anybody wants to speak for or against? Any other questions from members? With that, I think I will. We do have a quorum present, by the way, so we can now act on this bill. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 305 be passed and moved on to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Purcell, and thank you, Mr. Mead. Your bill is on its way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Okay. Members, we have not approved the minutes from our last meeting yet, so we're waiting for Representative Gottwald to get here to hear his bill. And while we're waiting, we can probably start with Mr. Tyler or some of the other people that want to come and testify on it. Dan is getting the computer ready. Representative Dowd, would you like to approve the minutes from the last meeting?
Certainly. I'll make that motion.
Representative Dowd moves approval of the minutes from last meeting. Any comment, question, opposition? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. We've done the minutes. We passed our first bill. We're going to go ahead and start testimony in a few minutes on the next bill. And what I'm hoping is we have about a half an hour or 35 minutes for those for and those against. And if we don't use all of that time, that's great. While we are waiting for the technological things to get done, maybe it's time for us to have some brief presentation from the newest employee of the Department of Commerce. Do we have a legislative update from anybody new, anybody at all? Anybody new from the Department of Commerce? Oh, Mr. Reich, look at that. He's coming down to talk. First of all, from the committee, congratulations on your new assignment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are looking forward to working with you, at least some of us are. And now we're, well, I'm sorry, should I not have said that? No. Any insight or wisdom or comments you have for the committee? Thank you. Okay. Well, we had to harass you a little bit. No, if there's anything you want to share with us, we're happy to have you here. If there's any words you have, feel free.
No, Mr. Chair, that pretty much sums up my experience with the committee. So, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, and excuse me. John Reich, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce.
And treats are coming next meeting. Got it. Okay. Thank you, sir. And with that, unless anybody had any tough questions for the department, we will let Representative Gottwalt and testifiers start out, and we'll go from there. Whenever you guys are ready with the presentation, or Representative Gottwalt, if you have any comments or questions beforehand, and Representative Murdoch, since Representative Gottwalt's not on the committee, do you want to move House File 8 and get it properly before us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 8, and I guess where should we put it from here?
I don't remember what you told me. Where do we want this to go from here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murdoch, we'd appreciate it if it were referred to the House Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this this great idea before you. We've been working on this this proposal.
Representative Gottwalt, we all know who you are, but just to make sure we're legal, identify yourself, please. For the
Representative Steve Gottwalt, District 15A. And what we have before you is House File 8, the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program. Members, this represents a change in policy for the state of Minnesota from a philosophy that has defined benefit sets that, frankly, in many ways are unsustainable, to a defined contribution, a subsidy that the state would pay to help people, low-income Minnesotans who otherwise cannot afford health care coverage, to purchase health care coverage that is already available in the state. This model is being explored at the national level as well as here in our state. It's not a new idea, but it's an idea whose time we believe has come. We are picking up support as time goes on, and that's been good. This has received a very thorough review and a good deal of input and new ideas, and again, we think it's time for it. I'm going to walk through the bill briefly, and then we'll turn it over for a presentation. So while they're setting that up, again, what we have is a defined contribution. What we developed is a sliding fee schedule subsidy that would be paid to, again, this is for Minnesota Care eligible adults only, adults without children, from 133% up to 275% of the federal poverty guideline. So this is the working poor. These are not the people we typically thought of as on general assistance medical care, the very indigent. These are people who are in a situation where they're having a difficult time affording health care coverage, and the state's legitimate role, we feel, as reflected in this bill, is to help them afford coverage that the rest of us have access to. I'll go into some of the benefits of this approach in a little bit, but the construct of the bill speaks first on Subdivision 1 about the defined contribution to enrollees. And I'll tell you that we have a base rate that, again, is adjusted for age and income. So you get less of the base rate if you're at the higher end of the income scale, and you get more of it as you get to the lower end of this, towards the 133%. The determination of defined contribution amount I kind of just described. It can generate anywhere from $122.79 for persons under age 21 to about $357.19 per month for persons age 60 and over. And a really important distinction, and I really want members to pay attention to this because we run into this all the time when we explain this bill. People on Minnesota Care right now are paying a portion of their premium. Let me repeat that. They are already paying a portion of their premium. So they have money that they're already taking out of their pocket and paying as their portion of the premium on Minnesota Care. As we move them to this new model, they still have that money. And then we add to that the premium that is listed in this bill. A lot of people look at the premium subsidy listed in this bill and they say, well, you really can't buy a whole lot on the market for that. And we agree. But the idea, again, is to take what they're currently spending on Minnesota Care and add to that this premium subsidy, and then that becomes the amount of money that we see as them having to go to market with. And it ends up, when you look at those amounts, there is good basic benefit coverage available in the open market for individuals. This is not a defined benefit approach. We acknowledge that right out of the chute. But that's a very important distinction, and it may cover some questions. The administration by the commissioners. So eligibility for Minnesota Care remains exactly the same. In fact, one of the great strengths of this bill is that it preserves eligibility for a group of people who, frankly, are threatened with losing state support for health care coverage. Right now, the Health Care Access Fund, for those of you who don't know, is $150 million in structural deficit. We are about 2 years away from that fund going bankrupt under the current model, at which time state law says we have to kick people off of health care coverage. So this is very important. This is an opportunity for us to, in a sustainable way, preserve eligibility and preserve coverage for people who need our help. The administration by the commissioner, again, the eligibility is determined the same way. You determine your eligibility for Minnesota Care. It's not kicking anybody off or changing that eligibility. The commissioner is then responsible for setting up a system under which the premium subsidy is paid to the health insurer of their choice. So they go out and buy purchase an insurance package on the open market. The Department of Human Services will then be able to pay the state subsidized portion, and then the recipient pays their portion of it. Very similar to what they do now with Minnesota Care. DHS pays for the state's portion of Minnesota Care, and the recipient pays their portion of that premium. Assistance to enrollees. This is important. In Minnesota, we have over 50,000 licensed and regulated insurance agents whose sole job is to find the right health care coverage for people in Minnesota. That's what they do for a living, and we regulate them accordingly and require training and all that. So this taps into that resource and allows them what would be set up is a system by which, once their eligibility is determined, they would be given information about how to contact people who can help them connect to insurance products. So there will be a means of helping these people. It isn't like we're just throwing them out there. There are actually lots of trained people and even online resources to help people find the coverage they need, and actually opens up a world of choices for them that they don't currently have access to. So what if they don't get approved? What if they pass through underwriting and they get denied coverage, pre-existing condition, they're in a particularly sick condition? The Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association has been a model in Minnesota that is now being mirrored in some of what we see from the ACA at the federal level, and is really responsible for so many people in Minnesota being insured. It's part of the reason we have one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country. We want to continue to see that model work. And so we see those people now being able to go to MCHA, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, much like they do in the private market anyway. We have we've actually increased the premium subsidy by it'll be 1.2 times the premium subsidy to compensate for the fact that MCHA is actually a 25% markup. They're allowed to increase their rates up to 25% above the regular private market fee. So we give them an additional premium subsidy beyond their normal subsidy to help them afford MCHA rates. And MCHA had some concerns about that still making them solvent, so we have guaranteed in the wording here that MCHA will be made whole out of the Health Care Access Fund. We think that's a very appropriate use of those funds as we move from traditional Minnesota Care to this. The fiscal note on this bill indicates that it will, in fact, help keep the Health Care Access Fund solvent, as well as keep MCHA whole. And that was negotiated with MCHA a couple years ago, actually. We are looking for a waiver, federal approval of a waiver, to include families with children, but that is not part of the bill today. We are simply seeking a waiver to do that. We recognize there are federal funds drawn down by the children. We don't want to lose that. But we do want to see more flexibility in Minnesota doing it Minnesota's way, saving money and improving health care outcomes and coverage. We have a section that requires asking if a person is a veteran. This was something we worked out with veterans organizations who recognize that a lot of times people who are low income and seeking state programs may not realize that they're actually eligible for much better Veterans Affairs benefits, more appropriate benefits. And so we ask the question, and if the answer is yes, they are referred to a county Veterans Affairs person so that they can be assessed for their eligibility for veterans benefits. We think that's another very strong part of this. And then we've kept in a section at the end, Section 3, coverage for lower-income Minnesota Care enrollees. We recognize that people below 133% of the federal poverty guideline are typically a fairly special needs population. And we saw some good things starting to happen with what we were doing with GAMC last year, certainly in the Twin Cities area. And so we want to continue the discipline of looking at the best practices that came out of that experience and trying to apply that to special needs populations. We know we can do better. The health systems in the state of Minnesota know that we can do better, and we think that discipline ought to continue for the sake of the care for lower-income Minnesota care enrollees. That kind of covers the structure of the bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. John Tyler for a presentation about some of the benefits of the bill.
That's fine. Mr. Tyler, welcome back to the committee. Please proceed. And Representative Gottwalt, I assume with the other testifiers that are here, I saw Mary Krinke, and we worked out a schedule, and everybody knows when everyone's going. So, okay. Thank you. Mr. Tyler, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Tyler. I'm on the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, my professional organization. Actually, one of four that really co-endorse, four professional associations that co-endorse, this legislation. Premise of this, also on the board of directors of the Minnesota Physician Patient Alliance as well. So we really have a dual finance, healthcare professional endorsement of this bill. This bill is an approach that is a bit of a financial planning approach, if I must say. It's what the market base does. It's how the market approaches health insurance, right now. And we're taking that actuarial science of financial planning and applying it to the Minnesota Care Adults Only population. And that's one of the reasons that this little bit different approach is one of the reasons that this has real reform written all over it. And it's not only does it have financial reform, but it actually has a number of other reforms that are very important from the healthcare professional community as well as far as reimbursements. It's moving the prospective enrollees in Minnesota Care from a primary care model HMO type of arrangement to an open access private fee-for-service model, giving additional choice and actually giving commercial rates versus very low negotiated rates to healthcare professionals, hospital, physician, and otherwise, to the providers. All of these things are really very, very important to allow a real reform to happen. So with that, I'll just launch into this presentation. It's the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Plan, as Representative Gottwald mentioned. One of the objectives, as I just mentioned, is to provide better, more comprehensive insurance coverage for adults without children who are currently enrolled in Minnesota Care, often called the working poor. Presently, they have an annual cap of an inpatient benefit of $10,000, of which they pay 10%, and the Minnesota Care plan pays 90% of that. So should they have an inpatient situation that goes over that, they run out of coverage after a total of $10,000. So there is a deductible right now of $1,000 on their current Minnesota Care program for that type of service. Not everyone is necessarily aware of that when they enroll in Minnesota Care. It's not a type of a plan that is actually available in the private market. I can't sell that plan as an insurance agent. I can't sell that plan, and if I tried, I'd lose my license because it doesn't meet the requirements for proper mandated benefits with a limit like that. Our objective is really to replace that $10,000 limit with really unlimited major medical maximum. So we're really changing the emphasis to truly catastrophic coverage that hopefully won't allow people to have to go through bankruptcy should they be faced with a situation with a very large claim on Minnesota Care. Our objective is to do this at equal or lesser cost to the state of Minnesota. Now, how does it do this? By using individual private insurance products in place of the current managed care program with Minnesota Care. In other words, what's available right now in the Minnesota marketplace to be purchased. Taking advantage of the private insurance industry's use of risk management and individual underwriting to provide, as well as the state-based high-risk pool that Representative Gottwald just referenced called the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association for less healthy individuals. And so the risk management process is the financial planning, the actuarial application of the actuarial science that actually makes this whole thing work. And there's been more than one individual that has looked at the rates that are provided in the Minnesota marketplace as compared to the current cost of Minnesota Care, and they scratched their heads and said, how can you possibly do that? How can you replace a $10,000 maximum benefit with an unlimited major medical policy maximum and actually save money? How can you do that? And the answer to that is through the proper risk management, the application of the actuarial science here that really is done very, very well here in Minnesota. The benefits of this approach is that, according to the fiscal note, significantly reduces the state's cost to cover adults without children who are enrolled. Fiscal note, at least of last year, indicates about $112 million savings over the biennial budget cycle for really about a third of the total enrollees presently in Minnesota Care. Brings long-term stability to the Minnesota Healthcare Access Fund, currently at risk in 2 years of really being insolvent. And what happens when it goes insolvent by law is disenrollment. It has to begin. So we're really faced with a private sector solution or really nothing at all, which is not really what I think most people would like to see happen. Another benefit is increased access to private health care providers by paying commercial reimbursement rates as opposed to medical assistance rates or Minnesota care rates to doctors and other health care professionals. Right now, there's a serious issue right now with people on Minnesota care and MA being able to find a provider, a health care professional that will see them. And the reason is because of the level of the really very low level of reimbursement. So we're trying to correct that situation. Better and broader coverage to adults currently enrolled in Minnesota care, no spending caps versus the current 10,000 annual inpatient limit for adults. That does not apply to children, it's just adults. Another benefit of the approach is it reduces the current problem of cost shifting from Minnesota care to private health care providers and health insurance marketplace, which is essential to controlling the upward spikes in private health care spending trends. So the term trend, you probably maybe have heard the term health insurance trend, is the rate of inflation that applies to health insurance premiums and to health care in general. What's fueling health care trend? Cost shifting is fueling health care trend. According to Milliman and Company, the underpayments to providers from a significant percentage of the health care professional marketplace onto those that have private sector coverage, creating an increase in cost and for the private sector coverage treatment is largely behind the rate of trend being 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation in the marketplace. If you're going to get to that, you need to put our healthcare professionals in a better position as far as their reimbursements are concerned to reduce the flame of the fire there that's fueling the cost shifting that's going on. This begins the process of doing that by adequately providing a reimbursement to our healthcare professional community using commercial carrier rates. This also supports and creates jobs in the private healthcare marketplace by ensuring the adequate reimbursements for doctors and other medical professionals. And this actually is true in the health insurance world. Health insurers aren't necessarily the boogeyman. They hire people. They provide benefits and pensions and so on and so forth in the marketplace, as do healthcare professionals as well. And I think if we're simply using, I believe between 1/6 and 1/7 of the entire U.S. economy is related in one shape or form to the healthcare delivery system. And so by adequately compensating and providing reimbursements to healthcare professionals and using the insurance industry as it exists actually helps the economy overall. I think we're all interested in doing that. Builds on the strengths of the community health centers and helps grow their outreach. This is actually a very important part of the program, and it's not entirely mandated or required. It's an option for individuals on Minnesota care to access the community health clinics. There are 96 of them available in the state of Minnesota, largely federally funded, partially state funded, and county funded, to access, and they're primarily there to allow people to access free care if they can't afford it otherwise. So this operates in tandem with the insurance plan of their choice that might very well have a copay or might very well have a deductible or an out-of-pocket expense, to them to access one of the 96 community health clinics that are available to them as well. These are freestanding little VA-type healthcare clinics that provide excellent quality care to people. They get very high marks there. So in a way, you might say this is a combination of using the private insurance market with a combination of perhaps maybe a little bit of single payer mixed in just for fun. Just to allow them access to health care if they can't afford their copays on the plans that they select. Enhances portability for continuation of insurance coverage for those who lose income eligibility for Minnesota care by using individual policies that they should and become non-eligible for continuation of Minnesota care subsidy, allows them to carry their private insurance coverage with them wherever they go. If they're in the middle of treatment, it allows them to continue that treatment really uninterrupted. They're not coming off of a plan and being asked to re-enroll in a plan at a very difficult time for them. This is the basic information. One of the things I would like to stress on page 2 of the bill, and then I'll close here, is that the center section lines 2.8 through 2.12. as well as the reimbursement schedule. Now, the reimbursement schedule here was taken from a basic plan that's offered by Medica that does include mental health and chemical dependency coverage. It does include mental health and chemical dependency coverage. It also includes the upgraded version. It has a couple of versions of the prescription drug coverage. It includes the upgraded version of the prescription drug coverage that is basically name brand and generics in both. So it's the more expensive version as well as the lowest deductible and the lowest copay type of structure. The reimbursement schedule is basically based on that type of structure. The lower the income of the individual applying, the higher the reimbursement. And on line 2.8, and 2.9, which indicates that this base reimbursement amount for the lower income people on the Minnesota Care allows for 150% of the base premium reimbursement. In other words, this base reimbursement is increased by 50%, allowing them to buy a more elaborate plan, a more comprehensive plan, if they so desire. So again, mental health, chemical dependency, prescription drug coverage, and enhanced in the reimbursements for the lower income individuals. Why is that consoling to us? Because the richer the plan availability for the lower income people, also it encourages them to purchase things like mental health and chemical dependency coverage because the reimbursement allows for it. Why would they leave money on the table and not purchase that if it's available to them? And there's no means of recapture premium if they don't buy that level of coverage. So with that said, I'll just close, and Dr. Vino will come after me.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler. Members, any questions? And Representative Gottwald, you have someone else that you wanted to have testify? Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a real basic question, and I'm sure it's just because I am new to this committee, but it seems like a good place to get this question answered. When we had our report yesterday, and we got that handout called Myths and Misconceptions About Health Insurance, and it says on one myth is that Minnesota residents with pre-existing conditions cannot purchase individual health insurance, and it goes on to dispute that myth. And then what I have read from and heard from some people that the disadvantage to a bill like this is that it people with pre-existing conditions can't go out and get health care. They would have nowhere to go. So, Mr. Chairman, in your wisdom and on this committee and some people who are more active in the Health and Human Services Committee, can someone clarify that for me? What is the real truth here?
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. I think we have someone that can clarify that. Representative Gottwald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, one of the great strengths of the Minnesota system, and again, one of the reasons that we have one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country, is the use of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. If you're considering the ACA, the Affordable Care Act from the federal level, this is the high-risk pool. Minnesota's had it for years. And the way it works is protecting our insured pools and yet distributing the cost of high-risk people across the state is done through this pool. So if I go for insurance and have a pre-existing condition, I may get denied by that insurance carrier, but I can access health care coverage through the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association on a guaranteed issuance basis. They have to give me coverage. It costs a bit more. We've accounted for that in premium increases or the premium subsidy increase in this bill, but you do have access to coverage, and that's part of why even people with pre-existing conditions are able to get coverage in the state of Minnesota, whereas in other states that might not be the case. So they do have access to coverage, and they have it on a guaranteed issuance basis at additional cost, but they do have it.
Representative Johnson was first. Representative Muller is to that point. And before we do that, Representative Dietrich, does that answer your question?
Somewhat. Can you just give me, Representative Gottwald, then an idea of what that additional cost is? And that people always talk about the 133% over poverty level and all that type of stuff. I need some context for some of that. What kind of income does that mean? And then what kind of additional cost?
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, I'll take your first question. Well, maybe I'll take your second question. You were asking about federal poverty level. 133% of federal poverty guideline for a family of four is approaching $30,000 a year. That's pretty low income. But it's certainly not down at the level of 75% where we've got some of these, the people who have been put on the early MA program, for example. People with typically with very heavy chemical dependency, mental health issues. These are more of what we would term the working poor. And then you move up from there. You take 133%, go all the way up to 275% of that number to where you've got some people who are making a lot more than that. Right now they have access to Minnesota Care. But again, as I mentioned, that's on an unsustainable footing. Help me with your first question again. Representative Dietrich.
Representative Dietrich.
Does anybody remember?
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Representative Davis, is it to this point?
Yes, to this point. I remember the question was how much more does MSHA cost?
Thank
I think
thank you,
can't
Representative
go
David.
125%.
I just table's paying attention.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, the increase under state law, it can only be 25% higher than the premium in the regular insurance market. So you get denied coverage here, you go over here, you can only pay up to 25% more. So there is a limit on that, and that's why we've increased the premium subsidy within the bill, too, so that they have more money to take with them to MCHA. So it is more expensive. That's the markup, and it's limited. They can't, you can't be denied and then go over here and have a 200% increase. The state requires that it be limited to a 25% increase.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald. So my understanding, looking at the fiscal note, at least from the Senate side, about a third of those in Minnesota Care will have pre-existing conditions. And then for them, roughly, and for them to go on to the MCHA, they're looking at premium increases of somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 or 25%, as you said. Is that correct?
Representative,
is that the kind of increases we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative, for the question. The answer is yes. We, here's another thing. We've all had frustrations with fiscal notes over the years, and we frankly dispute some of the assumptions, but let's assume it is a third. We actually think it'll be lower than that. We base that on the fact that the people we've been working with to create this bill have had actual experience of writing insurance coverage for people coming off of Minnesota Care. So we have a fairly good understanding of the population. But assuming it's a third, yes, there is an increase in cost for them to go to MCHA, but again, we're also increasing the subsidy payment to give them more money to take with them to MCHA.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, and also looking at the fiscal note, it appears that 10% of those currently enrolled in MinCare would not have any insurance, which would be roughly 2,000 people. Your comment?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, and thank you again for the question. The truth is, this is another assumption that we kind of dispute in the fiscal note. The assumption is that people will find it complicated to take a state subsidy and buy their own health care coverage. There is also an assumption that the fiscal note people shared with us that any time you make a change in a program, there are certain people who simply won't come along with it. And so in our discussions with them, they said, well, we figure that might be 5 to 10% of the people. The other thing they told us is if you had 100% of the people come onto this program, it still saves money. They told us that flat out. Maybe not as much, but it still saves a lot of money. So their assumption is that because it's more complicated, and I disagree with that. The legislative auditor just gave a report to our Health and Human Services Committee the other day that indicates that the sign-up process and enrollment process for Minnesota Care is, in fact, very burdensome. There are a lot of people who are eligible for the program who do not sign up for it. So we have some dispute about that, let's say. But, again, the idea here is people have an opportunity to access what the rest of us have access to with an advocator being, these trained, licensed insurance agents to find the coverage that they need. And if that's too complicated for some people, I argue if you're a person on Minnesota Care and you're now paying $130 a month to maintain coverage on Minnesota Care out of your own pocket, why would you drop coverage altogether because it's more difficult to sign up for private coverage? I guess that's kind of the disagreement we have with some of the people and their assumptions on the fiscal note.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one last question, as long as I have the mic here, Representative Gottwald. I also see that the fiscal notes specifically that the state would be unlikely to get a waiver for the federal program for this and that would then apply to childless adults, the program. So I guess I'm kind of missing a point on the bill if it's intended to be a comprehensive health care bill for families and children alike. Can you respond to that?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, again, a good question. Again, this bill applies to the adults without children. And so the fiscal note applies to the adults without children. It's about 100,000 people. We are seeking a waiver to try to get the adults with children included. That's what the waiver is seeking. So the adults without children are purely Minnesota. We don't have any federal dollars involved. We don't need to seek any waiver to deal with the people who are addressed primarily in this bill. So we would love to get other people involved in this model. I think nationally and otherwise, and you'll hear with some of the testifiers, this is a model that we're moving towards more and more, is more of a subsidized approach to providing health care coverage to low-income people. But we know we can move ahead with the adults without children, about 100,000 people. But we also would like to seek a waiver to try to see if we can get federal flexibility to include adults with children.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, you would concede then that the federal government has never granted such a waiver to a program of this sort?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, not to my knowledge. On the other hand, we just met with federal regulators from the Obama administration on the ACA, and they have indicated a tremendous willingness to be flexible about Minnesota because we do things better here. They acknowledge that up front, and they have indicated a willingness to be flexible. Again, the people who prepared the fiscal note are skeptical. I respect that. But we're also in a little different environment today than we might have been in the past.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
I'll skip it.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, Representative Gottwald, you have another testifier?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. My name is Peter Donnell. I'm a pediatrician who works in a small private practice office in Eden Prairie. I'm also medical director of a network of pediatric clinics around the Minneapolis and St. Paul area. And I am also here speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Physician Patient Alliance as well. Now, as a physician in these different capacities, I work hard to enhance the relationship between the patient and the clinician, whoever the clinician may be, because I believe that this is where the best medical decision-making takes place. I also believe that it leads to the best outcomes for the patients, and that's what we need in this state in terms of lower health care costs, best outcome for patients. I'm here today because I really do truly hope that the legislature will support legislation that enhances the patient and clinician relationship. I'm speaking in favor of House File 8 because it puts much of that health insurance decision-making back into the hands of the patients to meet their own individual needs, and I believe that that will give them, again, the best range of services that they see for themselves. I also believe that it will help them get, again, to that best outcome because they know what they need, they have an idea of who to get it from, and they know how to get there. And so I think that where somebody has to direct them totally in that, I think that is unfortunately a misconception that people have in terms of what lower-income patients have. They really know what they want. I also am speaking in favor of this legislation because I believe it will also give continued access to high-quality services in Minnesota. As a physician in Minnesota, I get very concerned about three current trends that are happening here of doing business as usual. First, I am very concerned about increasing health care costs, as I'm sure many of you are, especially for those who are least able to afford it. House File 8 works to increase the affordability of health care services without breaking the bank for the state of Minnesota. I'm also very concerned about access to high-quality health care services. And in this regard, it is very important to make a clear distinction between having simply a health care card and access to services. Those are really quite two different things. Seeing patients in state public programs is becoming increasingly difficult for those of us in primary care. And this is throughout the state of Minnesota, not just in the metropolitan area, not just in outstate Minnesota, but it affects everyone in Minnesota. It's not a matter of us as clinicians not wanting to meet the needs of the patients, but simply the cost of delivering that care is below the reimbursement we get for delivering that care is below the reimbursement for the cost to me as a clinician to deliver that care. There's not enough money coming in to pay for the services that those patients deserve. The reimbursement levels have, for example, caused most independent pediatric clinics throughout in Minneapolis to leave. And so there, right now, there's only one small independent pediatric clinic that remains in the city limits of Minneapolis as of this time. The third area that I get very concerned about is that Minnesota will become an increasingly unfavorable place for healthcare professionals to practice. January 2011 Commonwealth Fund report has shown that Minnesota has the ninth lowest Medicaid to Medicare ratio, reimbursement ratio in the nation for primary care services. And this is not just for pediatrics, this is for all primary care services. We simply cannot afford to see too many patients covered by Medicaid or other state public programs and keep our doors open and lights on. It's also getting very hard to attract new physicians in primary care to this state to provide services to the citizens of Minnesota. It is my understanding of House File 8 that it will work to enhance the level of health care services actually available to low-income Minnesotans in a more cost-effective and efficient manner. Simply giving people an insurance card, as I mentioned before, through an expanded Medicaid program will not guarantee access to those services. And this has been seen in a number of states where it's been tried. Simply giving them a card, 10Care is probably one of the most classic examples that I know of in terms of people that were given an insurance card, but there's no one there to see them. In addition to staying open for business, clinics that receive improved reimbursement levels through House File 8 will be able to provide a broader range of services, especially for those with complicated medical conditions. Coordination of care and patient education are both very important things to do, but they both cost a lot of money to provide in the manner that we need to provide them. House File 8 will allow for more of these services to be supported by the clinics at the point of service for the patients and their families. House File 8 will enable clinics to see a larger number of low-income patients because the reimbursement rates will be at a sustainable level for the clinic. Think of this as a small business. You're trying to keep your business running. If the cost of providing care is below the level at which you're getting, if the reimbursement for the care that you provide is below the cost, you cannot provide that service for any length of time. This is a sustainability issue. And again, it's both in rural and urban Minnesota. I'm certainly not advocating for extravagant reimbursement for clinics, but this is literally at a level to keep the lights open and doors open. Lights on and doors open. I'm sorry about that. Finally, the legislature will have more transparency. This is an issue that has come up. We'll have more transparency in where spending for healthcare services is actually going. This can serve as a basis so that the citizens of Minnesota who have a right to know this will know where the money is going and what services they're receiving in return for that. So, again, I support House File 8. I think it does a lot of good things that the current system is not doing, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you'd have.
Thank you. Doctor, any questions, members? I don't see any. Thank you, sir. Representative Gottwalt, do you have more?
Yes, we
anybody
do.
Else coming down? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Krenke. If you could, whenever you're ready, if you could identify yourself for the record. And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krenke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'd like to tell you today that the Hospital Association has looked at this bill and discussed it even at our board level, and we've made a decision to cautiously support this legislation. I just kind of want to start out with a general comment and then two specific concerns that we do still have with the bill. A general comment, and I know this first one, Representative Gottwald, is not going to particularly love, but this bill actually does line up fairly well with the federal health care reform bill. The population...
wait a minute.
Mr. Chair, what did you say?
Let the speaker finish here, Chairman Hoppe. The population below 133%, depending on what happens with the federal health care reform bill, the population below 133% is going to be on Medicaid starting in October of 2013. So the population above 133% will be given a subsidy to purchase health insurance on either a state exchange or a federal exchange. Obviously, we hope in Minnesota that we can be innovative and come up with our own state exchange rather than relying on the federal exchange. But having said that, this bill actually lines up with looking at the fact that the population above 133% is probably going to be buying a private sector product with some subsidy from the government. So, that being said, this bill is actually not in conflict with the federal health care reform bill. Sorry about that.
Now we see why he uses the word cautious support.
Now I have, I know by the time this session is over, I'll be so popular with everybody. But I now have two specifics that I would like to mention with the bill. What is probably going to happen is that people are going to buy high-deductible health care insurance products when they get this subsidy. And what happens, there's obviously trade-offs when people have a high-deductible health plan. The higher the deductible, the lower the premiums are that the individual has to pay. And that's the good news. The bad news is that healthcare providers, whether they be hospitals, physicians, other providers, will likely not get paid for that amount that is in their high deductible health plan. So we're seeing this already now as people come into the hospitals and they can't pay a $3,000, a $4,000, a $5,000 upfront deductible. And we believe that this bill could be improved if there was at least some parameter around how high that threshold on the deductible would be. And I have mentioned this to Representative Gottwald, and I'm hoping that as this bill perhaps moves through the legislative process, we could consider some maximum threshold that would be put on the level of deductibility. So that is our concern that we continue to have with this legislation. The second concern that I'd like to mention is on page 3, subdivision 6, and I know that this committee deals with MSHA a lot and not as much with the Health Care Access Fund, but this is subdivision 6. We are very concerned about the fact that any difference between the amount that would be paid from the subsidy up front would now fall back on the Health Care Access Fund. So the Health Care Access Fund is, in essence, backfilling MSHA, and we're not sure what that liability will be to our health care providers as we pay the provider tax into the Health Care Access Fund. We're not saying necessarily that we're opposed to using the Health Care Access Fund. We're saying that we're not sure what the amount of the liability will be from that, and that is a concern for us. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Krenke. You had mentioned that with a higher deductible that people are not paying the deductibles. I have found that with folks that have higher deductibles, generally the hospital and clinics are very good at working with those folks and receiving $50 a month or $75 a month or $100 a month until it's paid off. And if they don't get that, these are the people above 133% of poverty, so they do have assets, they do have some income. What percentage would you believe that you would not be able to collect? Because I think that hospitals and clinics are very efficient at collecting deductible amounts and are very successful, because if they don't, then they like take your car and your house and your farm. That's why some clinics are somewhat the largest landowners around, because they are very efficient at getting blood out of a turnip, if you will.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Davids, I'd like to respond with that statement in two ways. First of all, Minnesota hospitals are all under an agreement with the Attorney General in which we have a standard of collection methods that have to meet the standard that is in place. So the repossession of land, et cetera, hospitals have a standard, and I can get you a copy of that standard. So I can't speak on behalf of other health care providers, but Minnesota hospitals have a collection process that we have to follow. So that part of the statement. Now let me get to the high deductible health plan. Certainly hospitals, as well as all providers, work to try to get a payment schedule, but we still see at the hospitals one of the fastest growing areas of our uncompensated care is high deductible health plans. And I know you all know this, but Minnesota has one of the highest concentrations in the country of high deductible health plans. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it means people do have health insurance, but it does change the dynamics of our uncompensated care.
So. Well, Mr. Chairman, to Ms. Krenke, what percentage of folks with high deductible plans are not paying their deductible in some way, shape, or form?
Ms. Krenke.
Chairman Hoppe, Representative Davids, at the top of my head, I can't tell you the exact percentage. I can certainly go back and get a breakdown of hospital uncompensated care and try to look at what percentage is from HSAs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to see that.
Thank you, Ms. Krinkin. Representative Gottwald, did you want to respond to that point?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, just real quickly, I mean, we don't deny that deductibles can result in uncompensated care, but I would also point out if we're talking about putting people on a sustainable approach to coverage, Minnesota Care right now with its $10,000 inpatient maximum and its $1,000 deductible, you know, a lot of people make mistake that Minnesota Care is just the sun, the moon, and the stars for free. It isn't. That inpatient cost is already hurting hospitals, along with the low provider reimbursement under that program, which also hurts the hospitals. And Ms. Krinke and I have had that conversation as well. There are trade-offs here, but make no doubt about it, we're not necessarily moving to something that's going to hurt them to a greater extent than Minnesota Care already is.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Krinke. I guess in my experience of serving on the Works Comp Advisory Committee, there's been a lot of talk about cost shifting, and Representative Gottwald mentioned cost shifting. And I guess the question I got in my mind here is, what rate are these individuals going to be charged at? Are they going to be charged at the current Medicare rate or the rate they pay, or are they going to be being charged at the top dollar rate, or that, you know, a lot of big plans negotiate discounts with from the top paid? I mean, what rate are these people going to be charged at? Are they going to be charged the top price that an individual would come in? If I'm going to pay cash, I'm going to get paid the top rate, as opposed to if I have Blue Cross Blue Shield and they've negotiated a discount with the providers?
Ms. Krinke.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, that's probably a better question for Mr. Tyler to answer, because it depends on what product they buy. The hospital will then have, the individual have an insurance card, and it depends on what price that insurer has negotiated with every provider, and it'll be probably different everywhere. That's probably not the best answer. I'm probably not the best one to answer that question.
Representative Gottwald, can you shed some light on that?
Real quickly, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, thanks for the question. The nature of insurance, and this is one of the strengths, I think, of this bill, is we're tapping into commercial rates. So commercial insurance providers negotiate rates of reimbursement with clinics and hospitals. If you're a member of that health plan, you access those rates for what you're paying for premium per member per month or whatever it happens to be. If it's a straight fee-for-service premium insurance coverage, you are accessing that payment to providers. And so for what they can get on the market under these individual coverages, the hospital's going to get better reimbursement, because I can tell you Minnesota Care rates are much lower than commercial rates. But the person themselves will be treated as any other person with that insurance coverage. They don't end up paying more because they're on this policy. The reimbursement back to the provider is handled by the insurance company at a commercial rate, a negotiated commercial rate.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I don't know if I got my question answered, but I know from serving on the work comp that's one of the issues that there we've been tried for the last few years to try and get cost lowered for workers' comp, and that was the biggest cost, is the fact that they're being charged a higher amount than other people, and this cost shifting is one of the big issues within the health care of they're shifting the cost, and there's people that are getting their reimbursement rates are lower for Medicare and Medicaid and other issues, and that cost then gets shifted to other people that have insurance, and that's part of the whole problem with health insurance that right now, and especially with workers' comp right now, is that cost shifting goes on, and some people that have insurance are getting charged more, and that's a concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that's one of the things that we really like about this model, is that right now it's estimated 15% of private health care coverage rates are the result of cost shifting from public programs to the private sector. If we get on commercial rates here, we stop that cost shifting that providers have to do. Because Minnesota Care and MA and some other programs underpay providers, they have to charge the rest of us more money. If we get people on a path where they're on a coverage that pays commercial rates to providers, they no longer have to do that cost shifting. Granted, it's only with 100,000 people, so this isn't going to solve all of that 15%, but it begins to get people on a sustainable approach, not only from the state's perspective, but from a provider perspective. We think that's a strength about this bill.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Krenke, I wanted to just go back. You had said something that kind of got me thinking a little bit about the history of insurance, not only here in the state of Minnesota, but across the country. We've kind of come through an evolution of no insurance to a CMM, Comprehensive Major Medical, to the HMO model where you have a copay, to now we're moving to a slightly different, with the HSAs and the higher deductibles being introduced back into the market. How are hospitals dealing with non-payment of deductibles during the CMM days prior to, say, 1980 or 1990 when we started seeing the HMOs coming in? Could you speak to that?
Ms. Krenke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, one of the things we saw when the HSA penetration really hit Minnesota, the brakes hit on elective procedures. So one of the things that the hospital saw originally were things like knee replacement surgeries and sort of the non-emergency higher-end care that people could delay. When the HSAs first started, that type of utilization dropped. We are actually seeing it pick back up again, and I don't know if that's somewhat because the economy has gotten slightly better, or maybe people have delayed care to the point where now they've decided, you know, my knee really does hurt. I really do want to get that procedure done. So I think behavior has changed a little bit now that the HSAs have been in place a little longer. I don't know how far back you want. I don't know how far back you want me to comment on change in the marketplace, really. But
Representative O'Driscoll.
I guess my question wasn't necessarily on usage as much as it was on the CMMs that had the deductible, $1,000, $1,500 deductible, and someone came in to use your example, the knee replacement. Did they have the money at that point, or were they putting that on payments, and are we reverting back to something that the industry is used to doing but just maybe hasn't done in the last 30 years?
Ms. Krenke.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question.
Thank you. Is there any way, anybody that does know, or any way we can find that information? Would you be willing to check into that,
Mr.
and get
Chairman,
back to Representative O'Driscoll somewhere on the path here?
I can go back and look at some of our payment mix records and see where we might have had spikes in uncompensated care and some issues regarding that. I mean,
Representative O'Driscoll, is that...
Yes, thank you. It seems like we're somewhat reverting back with the HSA, and since the speaker brought it up, it just dawned on me that that's something we've been through, so we must have some data somewhere in our history on that.
Good question. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this goes way back to Representative David's comment, and Representative David's in Brownsdale, I believe it's still over 60% of the bankruptcies come from hospital bills. And so if we're going to drive up, what you're saying is it's easy to collect them, or they seem to be collecting them, as we drive it up, we're going to be having even more bankruptcies caused by this. So that's something that you have to also consider.
Representative Davids, did you want to reply to that? Otherwise, Representative Gottwalt is indicating that he might.
I'll let Representative Gottwalt respond to Brownsdale.
Representative Gottwalt.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Mullery, your point is well taken, but I would again point out bankruptcies are occurring on MinnesotaCare as well, because we have expanded eligibility under that program to include people who were never intended to receive that benefit, and we did not change the inpatient maximum. You can blow through $10,000 inpatient like that. And when we put people on this program and don't tell them that, and they have sufficient assets that they won't go on MA once they blow through that, they end up in personal bankruptcies. So, you know, in that sense, we're not necessarily solving that challenge by moving them to private coverage, but we're maintaining eligibility, maintaining coverage for a group that we really don't have a way to sustainably do that right now. And public programs are accomplishing some of the same things, unfortunately.
Representative Mullery, is that?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I realize that, but on the other end, I think we may be driving even more up.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Krenke, I wanted to go back to your discussion and sort of your cautious endorsement of the legislation and mentioning the high deductible issue. I was wondering if, I'm assuming, but please clarify for me, that your cautious endorsement sort of calculates that problem versus the what I assume would be better reimbursement rates under private insurance plans. Is that correct?
Ms. Krinke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon, that is precisely it. We also are concerned, and I think you'll hear from the next speaker, regarding the benefit set and concerns about mental health services and what is really in this package that an individual may be purchasing. So we're trying to weigh all of that, given the backdrop also of our state budget shortfall. And so our primary concern is that we maintain some coverage for this vulnerable population. So we're looking at all the different factors and trying to say this is an approach that if it does save the state some money and it does still provide some coverage, the hospital association is saying, yes, we should explore this and we're willing to look at this as a possibility to save the state some money, still provide some level of coverage. It's maybe not as good for some people.
Representative Loon.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that, because it was my assumption that reimbursement rates were a bigger financial concern for the hospitals than high deductibles. The second question kind of goes back to your discussion about dovetailing or whatever you want to call between the federal health care plan and that with the state subsidy. And I know there are some questions about how that may come into being or not right now, but if it does and the exchanges are put together and move forward, would the federal subsidy, and perhaps Representative Godwell wants to comment on this, be in addition to the state subsidy, or would that be something we need to go back and look at?
Representative Godwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loon, thank you for the question. There are a lot of unanswered questions yet with the ACA, and you know, one point on a nonpartisan note I would strike with this bill is there are some who say this is exactly where we're headed with the ACA, and I acknowledge there are certain elements of it here. The point is Minnesota has always been in the lead in health care reform, and if we enact this now and do this now, regardless of what happens with the ACA, whether the subsidies end up coming from the federal government or from the state, we have a program that is sustainable, something we can do with or without that. Now, whether we revert from a state subsidy to a federal subsidy is yet to be answered. And I think that's why we need to be concerned. If we want to maintain eligibility for these people and keep them covered with something, some basic health care coverage, we have an obligation, I think, to kind of do that our way. And then as the ACA comes along, I think this does match up well with it. And if there are federal subsidies to help us, you know, that may be good too. A lot of people have differing opinions on that, but I don't think we're sure yet. The rulemaking is still moving ahead in Washington. When we met with the federal officials, I don't think they had clear answers for that either just yet.
Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question here for Ms. Krinke. During last session, we had quite a bit of discussion, as you well know, about health care, and during that process, I was just kind of curious, for my local healthcare providers and hospitals and whatnot, I'm just curious what they told me who their customers were that were getting MinCare. I wonder if you could tell me who they are, because what they told me is that they're maybe the single woman that lives outstate and just can't afford healthcare, or maybe a veteran, maybe a homeless person, maybe someone suffering from mental health, might not have access to computers or a way to figure out the, you know, to change policies, and so some of that have the capacity, or I don't know how to say it gently, but that's who my local healthcare hospitals, Health East, and others told me who they were. I was just wondering if you have a different sense of who these customers are.
Sure.
Ms. Krinke.
Mr. Chair and members, last year our discussion was so focused on the general assistance medical care population after that program had been vetoed by Governor Plenty, and we worked to come up with an alternative. And that population is below 75% of poverty. That population, just as you said, probably would not have access to a computer, or a lot of them don't even have a home. And so that population, we felt very strongly that we needed to get that population into Medicaid. And obviously that action did take place with Governor Dayton signing the executive order. So that population below 75% is less than $8,000 a year and less than $1,000 in assets. So this population at above 133% is very reflective of what Representative Gottwald said, kind of a working poor person whose job may not offer health insurance, but that doesn't mean they don't have a checkbook. You've got to understand right now in Minnesota Care, they're currently paying a premium. So it's a combination of folks. Minnesota Care does have 60% of the enrollees are from rural Minnesota outside of the 7-county metropolitan area, 40% in the metro area. It is a broad range of individuals from all backgrounds, really. It's in many ways much more diverse than the GAMC population was. This population is a slice of Minnesota.
Okay. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Krinke. That's so I guess switching to Mr. Gottwald, Representative Gottwald, I can't really figure out, because it seems like it's basically Obamacare. I mean, it seems very similar to the federal program, so I'm just fascinated a little bit to why it appeals to the Republicans in the room. But, you know, that's just my feeling. It's my understanding historically when we've done health care reform that we've often kind of done a test area instead of, and I guess that would really be my only real contribution other than a little smarty comment. But it's just why we wouldn't consider, perhaps doing it in a county and just kind of working through it just to make sure it's something that would work, and then working through the bugs before we, ate the whole elephant or ate the whole big system. So I don't know if you're from St. Cloud, you've got three counties there. Maybe you could offer up one of them, but it just seems like it would be a good way to figure out what the customers really want, to talk in commerce terms, and to find out, how to implement this.
So
work through the bugs.
Representative Gottwald, which county would you like to eat the elephant?
The one that he doesn't represent.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Lilly, perhaps since it bears such a close resemblance to the ACA, we'd apply the ACA only to one county and give that a try for a while. I don't think that's going to happen. Actually, the resemblance of this to the ACA comes from a proposal that came out of the Bush administration, the Herbert Walker Bush administration, and which the Obama administration adopted as part of the ACA. The ACA is a combination of a lot of ideas from both sides of the aisle, actually. But this idea that you have a subsidy for health care coverage in the private marketplace for private insurance is not new. I didn't just dream it up. But it would be new to Minnesota. And the goal here, again, we're talking 100,000 people out of 700,000 people that are covered in Minnesota under public programs. If that's not a demonstration project, I don't know what is. We're working on a very limited piece, a group of people who are not, as Ms. Krinke pointed out, the very high needs population. These are the adults without children, so we aren't getting the family complexity issue in here. So it really is a demonstration project, if you will. And we like to think if this works the way we think it will, we should be extending this to other parts of the covered population, those 700,000.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I'd represent Gottwald. I'm really not kicking you in the shin. I mean, we're pretty close, actually. I mean, I think historically that when we've done some of these rollouts, you've kind of tested them, and I think there's really some merit to working through that. I think it's a fair argument that you try it somewhere and just work through it and test it, and I guess my concern is that we find out that we have hospitals that are, in trouble and find that they fail, or doctors are, put in danger or whatnot. So, I'm not as far away from you as, and I don't really care who started it, but it was too nice of a softball to pass, of course.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two points here. First of all, regarding Representative Mullery's question regarding bankruptcy, I would suggest that if we went with House File 8, there'd be fewer bankruptcies, because we're looking basically at above 133% of poverty. So these are people at a $3,000 deductible should not bankrupt, whereas a bypass surgery costing $200,000 and you got $10,000 in patient coverage. I realize some of that's doctor, but a $100,000 doctor bill, that probably will bankrupt these folks. So I would hope that it would lower that amount, because you're covering the top end where you can pay off over time the low end. That being said, I want to thank Representative Gottwald for bringing this bill forward, and it's certainly one that I'm going to support. There is one provision. I don't know if this bill would cover this at all or not, but on September 23rd, there's a situation. We earlier in the month of September 2010, I went to a Blue Cross Blue Shield meeting about, I don't know, 300-400 agents there in Mankato, and I've never seen agents walk out of a Blue Cross meeting before. Everything was going fine. The meal was good. Everything was great. and all of a sudden, it was brought to our attention that the Mayo Clinic and Blue Cross had not agreed on being participating providers and so forth. And so anyone whose primary physicians or doctors were the Mayo Clinic would not be considered participating providers. So what happened was, and then I asked the question, well, what if, like my main clinic is Olmsted Medical Group, and if something really bad happens, they refer you, and then they come to Mayo, and then you're considered a participating provider. We found out that under the new plans, now the old AwareCare plans are fine, so if you're southeastern Minnesota and you got an old AwareCare plan, keep it. It does not apply to groups. It's individuals on the new plans like Simply Blue and Go Blue and some of those plans, where Mayo Clinic is not a provider. So in my area, you know, if you have a cold or a sore thumb, you'll go to Olmsted and they'll take very good care of those issues. But if you need quadruple bypass, Olmsted Medical doesn't do that. You have to go to Mother Mayo at that point. So now we have situations where if you're going to get a new Blue Cross plan, I think the only ones that are covering here right now is probably Assurant and maybe MSHA. So how would your plan affect that, or would it still, you know, honor agreements between like the Blues and Mayo? I mean, you've got two 800-pound gorillas here. I mean, you got Mother Mayo and you got the Blues, and they haven't come together. I'm very, very concerned about that, because people in southeastern Minnesota are sitting ducks out there, because if you take a new Blue Cross plan and you have to go to Mayo, you're not covered above and beyond usual and customary. So how would your bill address that, or does it?
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Davids. You know, again, this is a bigger issue, because what we're doing is we're providing the state's role, again, is helping people afford what's already available on the open market. Now, when all of us go out and look for health care coverage, we kick the tires on these things, and we ask people like licensed and regulated agents around the state of Minnesota to help us sift through what do we need for health care coverage. If I want access to Mayo, I'm going to ask that question. You know, what is your provider network? That's one of the first questions people ask. Who do I have access to? Do I have access to my primary care doc? Do I have access to the hospital system I'm used to accessing? And agents are not allowed to lie about those things. They have to give you the truth about that. If you're representing a Blue Cross Blue Shield product, you're going to want to mention to people, by the way, you know, you're not, I don't know this particular situation, but you would have the opportunity to find that out. And then you have to make choices. So that's another thing this does, is it empowers people to make choices in the marketplace about what provider network are they going to access? What cost sharing are they going to do? Do they need a lesser deductible? Could they afford a larger deductible? So there is some flexibility there, but that's a bigger issue, because now you got people on commercial coverage, possibly people on group coverage, who need to be talking with the Blues about whether or not they have access to Mother Mail.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Dietrich, to this point? Well, go ahead.
To Representative Lilly's point, Representative Gottwald, you said that this concept is not new to is new to Minnesota, not to others. Are there any states that are already doing this?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, there are other states pursuing similar models. And again, as has been pointed out, the ACA actually envisions something very similar to this. There are other things that are going on with the ACA, with the insurance exchanges and the some of the other things that would happen. But this model, the idea of moving people from a defined benefit, an expensive, rich benefit set that we're guaranteeing to a certain extent, but not being able to afford, to a subsidy where we're helping people afford what's available, is not a new model. It's not a new model. Minnesota would be an early adopter, I think, and that's actually a good thing. It'd help us keep people covered who otherwise will not. We won't be able to afford to provide these people anything.
So, Mr. Chairman, is the
Representative Dietrich,
is the answer to that question no?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, If I understood your question correctly, are you asking, is Minnesota the first one to try this, or have other states tried it?
Are there any other models in other states that are similar to this?
Representative Gottwald.
The answer is no, not this particular model, but other states are pursuing this, and again, it's being looked at the federal level.
So we could be pioneers.
We could be pioneers, and we've actually been looking at this for 3 years, so
members,
it's not a new idea.
We've had a lot of questions here, and I know we have another testifier up here, and we are starting to run short of committee time, so feel free to identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Krenke.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sue Abderholden, and I'm Executive Director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And just so you know, we're a statewide grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. And nearly 100% of our board and staff either live with a mental illness or have a family member. NAMI is concerned about the proposed changes to Minnesota Care and the impact that it will have on accessing mental health services. In 2007, the legislature passed the Mental Health Initiative, which was a bipartisan effort to improve the mental health system. One of the provisions was the adoption of what we call the Model Mental Health Benefit Set for all public programs, General Assistance Medical Care, Minnesota Care, and Medical Assistance. These benefits were selected based on research and evidence of effectiveness and included things like crisis teams, residential treatment for children and adults, intensive outpatient treatment, assertive community treatment teams, adult rehab mental health services, and children's therapeutic services and supports. If this bill were to pass, these benefits, which are very cost-effective and treatment-effective, would now only be available under medical assistance and would no longer be available for adults under Minnesota Care. We're also concerned that not only won't people be able to access these particular mental health benefit set, but that they won't have coverage for any mental health or substance abuse benefits. Now, some of you might be saying to yourself, well, what about mental health parity? Well, mental health parity does not require you to cover mental health care. It just says if you cover mental health care, then you have to do it in the same way as you do regular health care benefits. But most importantly, policies for small employers are exempt, as are policies, individual policies for individuals and for families. Now, if you're looking at some of the major health plans that are out there, Health Partners 3 for Me covers mental health office visits, but only three of them, and the rest aren't covered until you hit the deductible, which is between $4,000 and $10,000. Many add extra to the premium if you want substance abuse coverage, which is true under Blue Cross Blue Shield. If you look at Medica Solo, I'd point out that there are three office visits that are covered under the plan with the $30 copay. These visits would include a psychiatrist, a licensed clinical social worker, a psychologist, or other mental health professionals. But after those three visits, the individual would have to reach their deductible, which is between $3,000 and $12,000, before the health plan would cover 80% of the visit. And it's really pretty rare to only need three visits from a therapist. If you need something more intense, say day treatment or residential services or even a mental health crisis team, the individual would be responsible for the entire cost until the deductible is met. Medica Solo also allows people to delete their mental health and substance abuse coverage and lower their premium. So there's going to be an incentive under this bill to purchase a policy that does not include coverage for mental health benefits. I would add that the federal exchange that will come into play actually requires coverage of mental health services. Now, for those with a pre-existing condition, such as depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, they'll not be able to purchase a policy, and so we'll have to go to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. If you take, say, a 36-year-old, maybe who has bipolar disorder, his income is, say, $14,403, not a lot. According to this bill, he would get about $204 to purchase a premium. Now, maybe he could have afforded the premium under Medica Solo, but due to his illness, he'll be denied. And so he'll have to go again to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, where his premium would be between $401 for a $500 deductible, or even it'll get down to $299 if he has a $1,000 deductible. So his choice is going to be to choose a high deductible plan. Now, high deductible plans create huge obstacles for low-income people. Study after study show that people delay medical visits due to costs. A Commonwealth report found that 38% of adults with deductibles of $1,000 or more reported at least one of four cost-related access problems, such as not filling a prescription, not getting needed specialist care, skipping a recommended test or follow-up, or having a medical problem and not visiting a doctor. 58% reported difficulties paying medical bills or are paying off accumulated debt. We are already seeing in our mental health system that families with high deductible plans cannot afford basic mental health services, and mental health providers are increasing their bad debt and losing out on funding. I don't know if you had a chance to read the Minneapolis Star Tribune today, but there was a whole story about the fact that high deductible plans really do limit access to services. Minnesota Care is the antithesis of a high deductible plan. There is no deductible under Minnesota Care, and I just want to disagree with a previous testifier. It's actually a 10% copay of hospitalization up to a maximum of $1,000. That's very different than a deductible. It's a copay. Minnesota Care covers the basic care and mental health treatment to prevent higher cost care. It is, if you will, an anti-catastrophic plan. It pays for the basic things, and you pay a lot more if you happen to be hospitalized. I will point out that when Minnesota Care was developed, the legislature understood the barriers of any deductibles. In fact, if you look at it, they allow children to go on Minnesota Care if they have insurance, if they meet one of the following: if their insurance doesn't cover hospitalization, if it doesn't cover med surge, if it doesn't cover vision — they have to meet two of these — if it doesn't cover dental, if it doesn't cover prescription drugs, or if their health plan has a deductible of $100 per person per year. So we recognized back then that high deductibles prevent access to care. NAMI really is concerned that this is going to create barriers, and people are going to really be kind of incentivized to choose the coverage that a plan that doesn't cover mental health. Now, you could say, well, it's their choice, but who among us knows what illnesses we will develop over time? 1 in 4 will develop mental illness during the coming year, but very few people think that they or a family member will develop depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety, or schizophrenia. And I truly cannot imagine that anyone here would allow or encourage a health plan to exclude coverage for heart disease, cancer, or diabetes. Marathon runners have heart attacks. Non-smokers develop lung cancer. Nothing in life is certain. But again, we as a society would be outraged if there wasn't coverage for heart disease or cancer. But for some reason, it's okay when it comes to mental illnesses. Their choice could affect our choice. When private insurance doesn't cover mental health care, it falls back on our public funding, such as state and county grants, to cover the uninsured or the underinsured. I'd remind you that you cut $11 million last year from grants that help cover mental health treatment for the uninsured and underinsured, and you've already voted this year to cut the money from the children's mental health under the Children and Community Services Act block grant that does the same for children who are uninsured or underinsured. Of course, more likely, it will be our criminal justice system that pays, for youth with untreated mental illness end up in the juvenile justice system and adults in the criminal justice system. 70% of young people in the juvenile justice system have one or more mental health diagnoses, and estimates are that 25% of our prison population and 60% in our jails have a mental illness. The other option, of course, is for families to simply take on more debt to pay for medications, treatment, hospitalizations, and more. We've all seen posters for fundraisers to help people pay for medical debts, but I can tell you there are no bake sales when it comes to mental illness. I know and recognize that you're trying to find new and more cost-effective ways of running Minnesota Care. Representative Gottwall and I have been talking about this and trying to figure out what to do, but I really just want you to know that I really do think this is going to have a negative impact on accessing mental health services. This is state-collected money, and I think you get to say how that money will be used. If you say, for example, that it has to have low deductibles and that it has to cover mental health benefits, I think that insurance companies will, in fact, develop those types of policies. So I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We do have a question. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
This would be more to Representative Gottwald. Would it be your position, if I understand it correctly, that a reduction in chemical dependency services and mental health services to those in need is the price we pay to moving to this more market-based system?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, no, that wouldn't be my position. I think the point that Ms. Abderhoven is making, and we agree with it, and we're continuing to discuss with her, is there are policies out there, and I think she acknowledged that do provide mental health care coverage, The problem is some people may not choose that, and that's true of a lot of other health conditions too. You may choose coverage that doesn't cover something that you might become sick for. I think our point is this is a sustainable opportunity for the state to provide financial resources to people who need coverage. The alternative is if we go back to the defined benefit set and the costs are extraordinary again and we bankrupt our health care access fund, we will have no coverage for these people. The state will not participate in helping them get any coverage of anything. And if we do that, we destroy eligibility, and we end up with people who not only don't have mental health coverage, they don't have coverage for anything else either. So there are trade-offs, but I think Ms. Abderhoven would agree, there are policies out there that the subsidy could help you purchase that do have mental health care coverage.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald does appear clear that there would be a reduction in mental health services and chemical dependency services for many more than currently exist.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, because this turns over the choice to the people receiving the subsidy, they take that subsidy and buy whatever package they can or want. That's hard to say. Who would choose what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, from what I hear from the testimony, that the kind of coverage that these people need probably wouldn't be available for the folks that probably need it the most, that don't have the kind of money to buy those, that kind of coverage that is needed.
Representative Gottwald.
At least that's what I heard from the testimony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it is possible people would end up accessing benefits that are less than they currently have in that area under Minnesota Care. That is absolutely true.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gottwald, I'm on the NCSL Public Safety Committee, and we've been learning that very quickly we're going to have to spend an awful lot more in the criminal justice area on people with mental illness or chemical dependency. And at the same time, I accidentally got into the healthcare area last year on a bill that I had no idea was going to get there. And I found out that this is an enormous issue for counties, and I don't see anything in here about what this could end up, knowing what I do about where we're going to have to go in the future, and what the counties came to me about last year, I can see an awful lot of sudden costs for counties in here, which I think we can't just, I've heard nothing about what's going to happen to counties, and I don't see anything from public safety as to whether it's going to affect our corrections. Those are real important issues too, I think, fiscally, when we're looking at this.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I will acknowledge those concerns exist. I think making the direct assumption that because of this bill we will see increased costs to counties is probably a bit of a stretch. But I would say we are continuing to work with Ms. Abderhoven, and we are trying to make this bill better day by day. And I think after 3 years, it's a very sustainable and good approach, but could be made better. Mr. Chair, we have one other testifier briefly, possibly, and then I assume you'd like to move to a vote yet today.
We would like to vote one way or the other, and we are running short of time, and we appreciate your testimony and your patience with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Bodine with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Manager of Health and Transportation Policy. I will keep this to an executive summary for you. We're here today to support exploring new models to restructure the state's health care programs. We know that it has to be done to ensure the sustainability of the programs in the future. Specifically, the Chamber supports new models that achieve better outcomes for Minnesotans, decrease the cost of health care, and decrease the rate of future increases in cost. The Chamber believes that House File 8, Representative Gottwald's bill, is an approach to both program sustainability and achievement of our Minnesota Chamber of Commerce Health Policy Committee's objectives. And with that, we urge you to move this forward and offer our support from a private sector if there's additional information we can gather or input, And I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? With that, we are running short of committee time, and I want to ask if there's anybody else in the audience that wants to testify for or against the bill. We're running short of time. We want to make sure we're not excluding anyone. Seeing nobody coming down, Representative Gottwalt, any further or any final comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope committee members will support the bill.
Thank you.
Chair, I'd like to request...
Representative Slocum.
I would like to request a roll call.
Roll call having been requested, we will have a roll call. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, with that, Representative Murdoch renews his motion that House File 8 be passed and moved on to the HHS Finance Committee. And we are going to have a roll call.
Okay, forgive me if I pronounce your name wrong. Feel free to correct me.
So what you're telling me is you're going to get Hoppy wrong?
Go ahead. Hoppy.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Not here. Anderson. Diane.
Anderson B. Yes.
Sarah's not here. Anzelk.
Nope.
Crawford. Doubt.
Aye.
Davids.
Aye.
Dietrich. On here. Johnson.
No.
Kiefer.
Aye.
Lilly.
No.
Loon.
Aye.
Mazerell.
Aye.
Mullery.
No.
Murdoch.
Aye.
Nelson.
No.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Slocum?
No.
Stensrud?
Aye.
Tilbury?
No. By a vote of 12 to 7, the motion passes. Thank you, Representative Gottwalt. Thank you, members. And with no further business before us, with that, we are adjourned.